Hope everybody enjoyed their August break. Come back refreshed and not too cantankerous. We have apologies, I think, from Sarah Kenny today. Peggy Smith will be joining us, also has some other commitments, so will be joining us by teleconference tomorrow, I think. And the only other apology I think we have to make is that Michael Cranky will be making his final appearance this week. But we'll say more of that later. Sorry? Right. Yes. It must be something you said to her, perhaps, Bernd.
Thank you. I thought you...
By teleconference tomorrow. Yes, she should. First item on the agenda then, the minutes of the July meeting. Does anybody have any comments or take those as approved? So I think we've got a lot on the agenda. And just to remind you, some of the projects that are appearing, particularly items 2 and 4 on the agenda, you might recall we have discussed several times before. So this is really decision time. So perhaps I can ask Jeho if you'd like to introduce the first of the topics, the limited issues on vesting conditions on IFRS 2. You leave your button, I will turn it on for you.
Good morning. At the last meeting, the committee requested the staff to conduct a follow-up analysis on accounting for a non-compete provision and performance target exceeding a required service period, and also think about the course of action that the committee can take with this agenda project. And we find the proposed definitions, including performance conditions, non-vesting conditions, and contingent feature. Follow-up analysis, the course of action and refined definitions are shown in agenda paper 2A, 2B, and 2C, respectively. First, please look at the agenda paper 2A. At the last meeting, we presented a package of examples to illustrate step proposal. As part of it, we recommended a non-compete provision should be presumed to be a contingent feature, and a performance target should be fully combined with a service requirement for the entire period between grant date and performance target date in order to constitute a performance condition. However, against the staff recommendation, some committee members put arguments that the employee refraining from working for the entity's competitor should be regarded as providing service toward the entity, and a performance target should be taken to constitute a performance condition even if its achievement is determined over the period exceeding the required service period. In response, the staff performed an additional analysis on these two examples. First, non-compete provision. Given that there is no generic definition of service across IFRS, the argument that the employee is providing service for the entity as long as they refrain from working for the entity's competitor can be made by reference to paragraph 8 of SIC 27, which indicates refraining from certain significant activities may be regarded as providing service. But we think it is stretching the meaning to analogize to paragraph 8 of SIC 27 because it addresses only specific transactions, i.e. lease, rather than all sorts of revenue-generating transactions. In addition, we have some concerns over the argument. looking at the U.S. GAAP guidance, U.S. GAAP guidance and practice, substantially all non-compete provisions are taken to be a clawback feature, a kind of contingent feature. So the argument will lead IFRS 2 diverge from U.S. GAAP. Also, even if a non-compete provision is considered to be equivalent to service condition, the service payment transaction should not be regarded as a transaction with employees, but as a transaction with parties other than employees, because the service is provided in the capacity of non-employees rather than in the capacity of employees. Therefore, the service itself must be measured at its fair value on an ongoing basis as the service is provided. But we think this is hardly practical. In summary, we think the argument that the employee is providing service for the entity as long as they refrain from working for the entity's competitor is not appropriate for this agenda project purpose. Let's move on to performance target exceeding a required service period. The argument that a performance target should be taken to constitute performance condition even if its achievement is determined over the period exceeding the required service period is thinkable because the description of performance condition in current IFRS 2 does not explicitly require a performance target to be fully combined with a service requirement. Nevertheless, we think the argument is difficult to make the case because the current definition of vesting condition already makes clear that a vesting condition, including performance condition, must determine the entity receive the service that entitles the counterparty. The employee is free to leave the entity after the required service period has passed, and therefore, the performance target only may not determine whether the entity received the service that entitled the counterparty to the share-based payment. On top of that, according to our investigation, there is prevalent view in practice that if a performance target achievement is only determined after any required service period, then the performance target does not constitute a performance condition. Nonetheless, we think that the definition of performance condition needs to reaffirm and articulate that the performance target should be achieved while the counterparty is providing service. Against this background, we would like to ask the committee these questions. Question 1, does the committee agree with the staff recommendation that a non-compete provision should be presumed to be a contingent feature? Question 2, does the committee agree with the staff recommendation that a performance target should be fully combined with a service requirement in order to constitute a performance condition? Question 3, does the committee agree with the staff recommendation that a performance target that is not fully combined with the service requirements should be seen as a non-vesting condition? We hope the committee discuss first non-compete provision and then move on to performance target exceeding the required service period.
Okay, thank you, Jai Ho. And just to remind you, these are the two outstanding issues that are standing between us and getting to a conclusion on how we can finalize this project. So can we have any comments? Does anybody not agree with the staff recommendation on question number 1? Okay, so we'll take that as agreement. Peggy?
Not agree. I think requiring somebody not to compete, even though they're not providing service to the company in a way they are, by not providing service to somebody else. So I would view that as a performance condition.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I share the same view with Peggy. I understand the staff proposal is practical, and it will not create divergence with the United States-U.S. gap. However, one thing I'm wondering is, isn't there any case that refraining from working for competitors is one of the most significant part of the contract of share-based payment, especially when the employee is the engineer or a technical expert. The special technique or knowledge is the key factor of having a share-based payment, and it could be very critical. And so the main purpose of share-based payment may be preventing him from working for the competitor. Therefore, in such case, those elements is heavily reflected in the calculating the number of share-based payments to the employees. So if we say, simply say it's not a non-vesting condition, it could distort calculation. So just my concern is if the standard simply says it's not a vesting condition or it's just a clawback or something, there is a possibility that it could distort the correct figure of the expense which the company should bear.
Okay, thanks, Laurence.
Before I conclude, I would like to make sure that I understand the consequences of treating it as a contingent feature, because it is said in the paper that you treat it then similarly as reload feature. So in the event that effectively the employee goes and works for a competitor, so an event occurs that triggers recognition of the contingent feature, because it is treated similarly as a reload feature, and because I understand that you never reverse an expense that has been recognized once an award is vested, I assume that when you have a clawback, nothing happens in terms of the income statement other than a repurchase of treasury shares. Do you confirm that my understanding is correct of the consequence, meaning that, in effect, non-compete agreements will never, ever have any effect on the income statement? Is my understanding correct?
Rahel or Michael, do you want to respond?
Generally, if a company is entitled to receive cash, the return of the shares, or other things, they should then have a corresponding gain of some sort in the income statement, and you're only going to be recognizing that in the period that it actually becomes triggered and occurs. It wouldn't simply be the so-called repurchase of those shares for zero compensation.
Then we are obliged in paragraph 23 of IFRS 2 that says that you do nothing after an award is vested. Because in contingent feature, takes place, by definition, takes place after the award is vested. So paragraph 23, if I'm not mistaken, says that nothing can happen once an award is vested. So we are modifying paragraph 23 in case of...
It's a separate transaction.
...features?
I think what Laurence is saying is that the share-based payment transaction itself and the recognition of the expense that derives from that, and presumably then the credit to equity on the other side, is something that is handled up to the date of vesting. If there is a contingent feature which is activated post that vesting period, it's accounted for as a separate transaction in the same way as other similar types of transaction. And the cancellation of an equity instrument,
Yeah. The
implication is that would be a cancellation. It wouldn't affect profit and loss.
Yeah.
Be a change within equity. But
if
that doesn't
the
seem
answer,
to be clear.
I would like it to be clear.
Sorry, Michael.
I was going to say something very similar to you, Bob, and I think it's if the consequence of breaking the non-compete is a repayment of cash, if it was, say, a cash-settled share-based payment award, for example, or if the consequences of even breaking a non-compete with an equity-settled share-based payment was that the employee had to repay cash, which would be the case, for instance, if they had sold shares, then I think there would be that consequence to account for. I'd say it's a separate transaction because contingent features are things you account for as and when they happen. But I agree, it does raise the question about, well, if it was the return of the shares, how would we deal with that? And is there a basis for recognising a credit in income? I'm not sure that there is. No.
Now I don't understand.
Sorry, did you want to come in on this one, Scott?
Yes. Now I'm confused, Michael. I think you just said that if what's returned is cash, we're going to credit income, but if what's returned is shares, we aren't. I had understood that contingent features, as Bob described it, are a separate transaction. So if an employee has to return compensation, we would reverse that compensation expense. So I thought we were crediting income no matter what was returned. It shouldn't make a difference whether the employee happens to have subsequently sold the shares or not. The point is that we have a clawback that has been triggered, and that reverses the compensation expense. I thought that was the implication of recording it as a contingent feature rather than a vesting or non-vesting condition.
I think so. Dito?
That's exactly the same concern that Laurent. If the question would have been, do you agree that non-compete is not a service condition, I would have said yes. But what is the contingent feature? I mean, there might be non-compete conditions that are non-vesting and others that are vesting conditions. It depends on when you get entitled to get the shares. There may be plans when you get the shares before when the non-compete period starts, and then you have to give them back if you don't follow the non-compete provision. Or there might be a non-compete provision where you get the shares only at the end if you met the non-compete requirements. So my understanding is that we would account for that differently. The last one would be, or the first example that I brought would be a contingent feature, the other one would not be a contingent feature. That doesn't make sense to me. That's why I was also asking myself, how do we account for contingent features? I was not sure how we account for them. That was the question that Laurent asked. So the way I see it, the simple solution would be that do not distinguish contingent features. They are non-vesting conditions, and they should be accounted for by taking them into consideration for the fair value as grant date, as long as there are no service conditions, which I think is the right answer. Non-compete is not a service condition. But to distinguish non-vesting conditions, also the example that I just gave, and contingent features, I don't see a reason for that. And I don't know how to account for contingent features.
Perhaps we're trying to fit everything into a small container here when there are two different issues that are going on. And I think you described them very well there, Guido, that the one circumstance would be that if the shares vest at the end of a particular period, and the non-compete provision that extends beyond that period, if the employee is free to dispose of the shares in any way that they want, the effect of the non-compete provision is an extension or a separate agreement almost that's been bundled into this agreement that requires compensation to the entity in the event that the employee does work for a competitor. In the second case that you described, it sounds as if the shares would not vest in the sense that the employee is not free to do whatever he or she wants with them until the non-compete period has been completed, in which case that would be aligned as a vesting condition. So we're talking about non-compete agreements in two different ways that have two different impacts. But I think in the second case, you would expect it to be treated in the same way as a vesting condition.
Right.
And in the first case, it is in effect a separate agreement that's been included together.
That actually is my question. Do we want to have a different accounting for those two situations?
The only reason that we're talking about these conditions is, of course, we do have different accounting already, that some things are trued up, remeasured, depending on circumstances as they go forward. Others are not.
Yeah, but that's the distinction between service conditions and performance conditions as compared to markets and non-vesting conditions. What we are talking about here is vesting or other vesting conditions and post-vesting restrictions. And I know with practice out there, some people think that also post-vesting restrictions should be accounted for by including them in calculating the fair value at the grant date. Now, I can see arguments for both ways to discount for post-vesting restrictions differently, but I think we have to make clear that the committee understands what the implications are. We say, well, contingent features are this, and they are accounted for differently as compared to vesting conditions, which might also include the non-compete condition. So that's the first example that I can.
Andrew?
Sorry, I was going to make a slightly different point, although I do think we obviously need to be absolutely clear on our subsequent accounting. Overall, I didn't have a major problem with the conclusion on this, but I mean, I think if we are going to go down this route, there are various things that staff might need to take into account when drafting the wording or draft basis for conclusion, because I think a non-compete agreement, at least in an IFRS 3 world, is an actual asset when you do a business combination, and we're calling this a contingent feature, not a. I just wonder how consistent we are with other standards if we're going to go down that route.
You're not suggesting that we recognise an intangible asset for every share-based payment transaction. Ruth?
I had a similar concern to Laurence and Guido in respect of what is a contingent feature. And I think if we're going to use that in the standard, we need to define what it is and what the accounting is. And I think that distinction that Guido made is important. But having said all of that, looking at this whole project, and I'm not sure whether we're going to discuss Agenda Paper 2C or not at this stage, but I'm quite concerned about differences in wording that we might introduce here to try to get the same outcome as under US GAAP, which is what many moons ago we thought we might try to do. I'm worried that if we try to define things using slightly different wording, people might read the standard and get a slightly different answer or think we mean to say something different. So at the end of the day, when I looked at your argument about whether a non-compete provision is a service or not, at the end of the day I said, well, there are arguments both ways. Does it really matter? If we try to achieve consistency, let's get the consistent answer and let's help people to get to the consistent answer, because otherwise this project will go on for years, and that's what I'm concerned about. So I think we do need to define what a contingent feature is. My understanding is that it's not defined in US GAAP. I think people seem to know what it is. But we might need some help. We might need some help and we might need a definition of it, but I'm really worried that by creating new definitions and putting new words in, we're actually going to make this even more difficult for people. And we could argue conceptually the way things should and shouldn't be, but I thought right at the beginning of this we were trying to achieve greater consistency, not more disparity.
Okay. Final word then, Laurence?
Yes. I'm concerned about the inconsistency we might be getting at for contingent features when effectively there is a clawback. Because currently what is being proposed is that we treat non-compete agreements similarly to reload features. And in the text, we say that a reload feature shall be accounted as a new option grant if and when a reload option is subsequently granted. So for reload features, we say we don't touch the expense that had been previously recognized. You only recognize a new grant. And now, if we go the route saying that you reverse the expense that you had recognized in case of a clawback, I can't see how we account non-compete agreements similarly to reload features. So I think there is an inconsistency here to be solved. Either we treat it similarly to non-vesting, either we treat it similarly to vesting with a true-up, either we treat it similarly to reload feature, in which case, for me, there is no reversal of an expense.
Sorry, Laurence, I'm not quite sure I understand the connection between the clawback and the reload. They seem to be going in totally different directions.
But if you put the paragraph there, the
existing conditions dead,
you don't treat the
non-competitive agreement existing conditions, but you treat it similarly to reload features.
I think, at least from my perspective, that that's drafting that we obviously need to improve. What we were trying to get across is that a reload feature does not impact the granted fair value measurement or have any current accounting consequences. It would be accounted for if and only if something happened in the future. Similarly, we believe that a non-compete provision is the entering into with generally a former employee or soon-to-be former employee in the company, and if and only if something is triggered, that transaction, that penalty, will have to be accounted for. So it's not actually the, I would say, necessarily the unwinding of the stock comp directly. What it is the company recognizing now that someone else has breached this contract, I now have a gain back. I'm going to be receiving something of value back, either shares or cash or whatever else. And we were simply trying to say it should be a subsequent accounting impact.
Okay. Can we not go into paper 2C there in the words, because that isn't what we're discussing. It's the issue in 2A. Scott?
I was just going to say roughly what Michael did. I mean, in U.S. GAAP, these are both treated as contingent features. That doesn't mean we think you make the same entries, because when the reload feature is triggered, the company issues something additional to the employee. When the clawback is triggered, the employee gives something back to the company. And the point is, whatever it is that happens, you account for it when it happens. That's where the similarity lies. And to Ruth's point, I suppose in U.S. GAAP, we think we know what a contingent feature is, but to be honest, I have never seen anybody successfully argue that anything other than a clawback due to a non-compete or a reload is actually a contingent feature. Everything else winds up getting evaluated as some other kind of condition, and of course in the U.S. we have a bit of a cheat in the stock comp literature, because if it isn't a market condition, a performance condition, a service condition, or a contingent feature, it's a liability award. And so then we just record all the changes. So we don't really need to classify it. And you might think that people would then try to argue that a lot of things are contingent features to get out of the liability award classification, but I think what really happens is that they don't put those things in because the literature is written such that, you know, it essentially says, if you don't know what it is, it's a liability.
Okay, I quite like that approach.
I like it too. I'm not proposing it, though.
No, that wouldn't be consistent with what we're doing. Well, perhaps then the solution is, instead of inventing new terms, is actually just to specify how we should account for these features. But the real question is what your preference is as to how we should do that. Guido?
I was asking myself from a perspective of the entity, which I think IFRS is written from the perspective of the entity. I understand that the staff is trying to change that, which I would not agree with, because I think IFRS 2 should be from the perspective of the entity. And as it's still written, I was asking myself what is the reason to account for a non-compete provision post-vesting or after-vesting differently? From the perspective of the entity, I don't see a difference. So my proposal would be, if there is no difference, account for them in the same way, and that is include them in the grant date for value.
One accounting is better than two. So the approach following the lines of argument that the staff has got, I think, is that if there is a non-compete provision, it obviously doesn't apply whilst the employee is still working for the entity and providing active service. From the perspective of the entity is receiving service, so employee compensation during that service period seems reasonable. And the non-compete provision becomes relevant subsequent to the employee providing active service. And I know there are some employees who don't actually do very much anyway, but on a formal basis, if they've left the employment of the company and have a non-compete provision, then perhaps the consequences of whether that non-compete provision is exercised, that is, if the employee does contravene the provision and therefore has there is a clawback that the entity has, that the entity should just account for it subsequently. So regardless of the circumstances, would that approach be acceptable? Jana?
I have to say I'm not convinced that approach does make common sense. And I was thinking about Guido saying, should it be the same? Does it make any difference from the company whether or not you get these shares back or you don't issue them or whatever before or after vesting? And I would argue you do. There is a difference because vesting is a key date. At that point, and maybe I'm not looking at it from the company perspective, but I'm thinking about what you've said. They become the employees. They are vested. That's what vesting date means. So to me, if you say the vesting date is actually includes the fact that once you've left, you've got 2 years or whatever, and you do determine that the vesting date is after a non-compete period, then to me, you account over that full period. I agree it's not a service condition, but to me, it is one of the vesting conditions that you do not compete.
So just to clarify, when you say you account over that period,
sorry,
if the non-compete agreement is given to somebody who retires at the age of 60, and the non-compete is that there's a clawback at any time until that person dies, and their life expectancy at age 60 is still 25 years, you continue to account for the service over the 25 years, or do you stop when the person stops active service? This is really the issue, because I don't think there's going to be much difference if the service period determines the, if you want, the attribution of the value of the share-based payment award whilst service is being provided. And the consequence, whether you want to call it a true-up, if somebody has to claw back or doesn't, is an adjustment that comes subsequent to that date.
And maybe this.
I just thought it was just thought it was cleaner to say do it up to the date on which service requirement stops, even if perhaps in your mind that doesn't equate to the best because there is a restriction.
And maybe this comes to your second point. In fact, in terms of the performance target exceeding the required service period, so that they're actually linked to that, and therefore,
I shouldn't have peeked ahead, but
yes, as I said, I was thinking aloud when you put me on the spot, Bob, rather than having thought about it before.
Well, you've been so quiet for the past half hour, Joanna. I'm very concerned about you. Guido, who's not been very quiet, though.
Actually, I was looking for the same arguments to convince Joanna about this thing. I understand that from a legal point of view, there's a difference because if they vest and I get the shares, I can do with them what I want. But at the end of the day, you know, looking from the company's perspective, I would say there is no difference. It depends on whether the employee meets the requirement to non-compete, and so I would also not true up it over the vesting period. Also, I would, you know, services provided up until vesting, I would include the non-compete, whether it's clawback or not, within the grant date fair value, and that's it.
All right. When you say you'd include it within the grant date fair value, it's the probability of the clawback as opposed to what the market participant's view of that might be.
Right.
Yeah, okay. All right. So shall we just consider that then, that whether we call it a contingent feature or not. This is something that we're going to describe specific to these types of arrangement, the non-compete arrangement. And if we can get it in a more generic sense, then that would be better. But that the approach to follow then is that the possibility of the clawback is taken into account in making the estimates in the same way as the probability of any other forfeiture, employee forfeiture, would be up to the date when the service period has been completed. And then at that date, we stop the adjustments to the share-based payment if the clawback, because the non-compete agreement is breached in a subsequent period, whatever that is, it's accounted for as a separate transaction. And that would be a reversal or something, so there wouldn't be a distinction between whether it's equity or cash settled. It would simply be that either there's been a repurchase of shares by the employee surrendering the shares, or a payment of cash either in compensation of those shares or because it was a cash settled award, and that would be then a credit as a some sort of a gain. Yeah. Would that be acceptable? Does anybody object to that approach?
Yes, sir.
Is that okay?
Well, I wasn't entirely clear what you said in the first case. Are you saying we take your kit in the first case in relation to the non-compete agreement up to the point of the end of the relevant service period? It's in the fair value or it's in the true-up calculation?
If you start off by expecting that people will not breach the compete agreement except in perhaps 1% of cases, then you would factor in the 1%. And if for some reason you think as you're getting close towards the end, maybe your business is not doing too well and the competitor is doing exceedingly well, and you think the probability of the non-compete being breached would be 75%, then you would true up for that 75% change in expectation, in the same way as the expectation of any other forfeiture, failure to complete the service period. Up until the end of the vesting period, and then that would be it. So it's dealt with as a contingent feature, not as a vesting feature. So the other factors that determine vesting would then govern the date up to which you would true up.
If I can...
No, sorry. Don't.
So I don't understand how you include into the fair value the probability of someone breaching...
Not into the fair value, but the same way that you have the probability that somebody will not complete the service period. So the expectation that of all the employees, 95% will complete the service period, 5% won't, 5% will forfeit. So it's an arithmetic adjustment. It's not a market-based estimate of what a market participant would factor in calculating the fair value of that award.
You estimate the chance of those who leave the company with this condition breaching.
Yeah.
I find that quite difficult from a practical point of view because, I mean, you have numbers on how many people stay in the company until the vesting condition is fulfilled. But breaching a condition post service, I don't know that. I'm not sure that you have enough basis for.
I'm sure you don't, and I'm sure that most people will.
So that sounds arbitrary.
100% that will not breach.
But that sounds quite arbitrary to me.
So
if someone decides to buy a house,
can you give me an academic solution to this one?
No, I don't.
In other cases, factors that affect the value of the award are taken into account in one of two ways, either in determining the value of the award or in applying a probability to the award being converted or earned ultimately by the employee. So you've got a choice of those two. I wouldn't like to introduce a third approach. But that's why I said it's the probability.
I would rather say we don't include a probability, but say we start from the point that we think that they are not breached, and then in a second transaction, if they are, then
which sounds like we've come back to the original staff recommendation,
which, I
which
liked.
Is the contingent feature.
Which I liked.
Right.
But, okay.
Guido, are you going to accept that? Yes or no? He's your countryman.
He's actually from Bavaria, which is. Well, you would not be surprised to hear from me that that's why I said I don't like this contingent feature thing. But coming back to how to account for that, I agree with you. There are two methods to include conditions. One is the true-up issue, and the other one is included in fair value accounting, or measuring the fair value of grant aid. And I think about all the other vesting conditions that would be included in grant aid fair value, I could, you know, come with the same argument and say, how could you do that? How could you calculate that? I understand that the board, when wrote IFRS 2, said, well, for some of the conditions, it will be hard or not reasonable to calculate that or include that in the fair value calculation. For instance, whether employees provide their services. That's why we use the true-up method there. You could come up with the same argument for the non-compete and say, well, you cannot include it in the calculation of fair value. That's why you should account for it the same way as the true-up, which is a problem because we decided first that it's not a service condition. So how will you apply the true-up method for the non-compete after the service period? So that's why my thinking was you include it as the other vesting conditions in the fair value measurement. You once do that, and that's it. You never change it.
Okay, so we'll put you down as a fair value zealot then. Scott?
With regards to the accounting that you described, Bob, I don't mind taking into account the probability up front, making the adjustments, but then I would say we'd have to play it out all the way. So if we estimated a 1% chance that the employee would breach the non-compete, then I think at the end of the non-compete period, we'd have to say, did he or didn't he breach? And if he did not, then we'd have to bump up our expense. So I think we'd have to true it up all the way through the contingency period, not only if the clawback was triggered. I'd be fine with that accounting, although I prefer the staff's proposal.
Ross?
Yeah, I do have a problem with the suggestions because of the lack of consistency, how you do with the reload features, and the fact as well that, as you just said, that true-ups, it's only when you have service conditions. So, I mean, my preference would have been a contingent feature that you account only when the event occurs, except that for the subsequent accounting, in case of non-compete, I would just do, if it is a clawback of equity, repurchase of equity, and if it is a cash that is returned, again, at the time. But I would not reverse previous expense because I have paragraph 23, the second sentence, that tells me that after you had vesting, the entity shall not subsequently revert the amount recognized for services received from an employee if the vested equity are later forfeited. I have difficulty seeing a reversal of the expense when I read paragraph 23.
So to be clear, what is your solution in the event that there is a clawback? What are your journal entries? What are you going to debit? What are you going to credit? If you receive cash?
If I receive cash, it's a gain, because I have the cash. If I receive equity, that's a repurchase of equity on me.
So what is that? A debit to?
It's as if I it's a repurchase of own shares.
Yeah. What are the debits
for
and credits?
Value.
What are the debits value and credits?
You have a zero value for this. You have you have one more share for zero value.
Sorry, what are the debits and the credits?
Debit zero, credit zero, but it's...
No, but you've got something of value. The shares are worth something of value, 100 currency units. So you would debit treasury shares with 100. What would you credit?
What does IFRS 2 say when you repurchase shares that
are
for value that is different from the cash you pay? I think that it's the nominal price.
mean, this is a situation where this person has breached a contract with you and has to make a payment. You're just accepting that payment in the form of shares. I was right with you, except I would have thought that if you get back equity, you do that's a fair value transaction. So you got back something worth 100, you paid zero, you have a gain. The same way as if you were suing somebody and they said, wait, drop your lawsuit, I'll give you back these shares. You have a gain.
Yeah. All right, we have to make a decision now. So the proposal on the table now, I think with some of the comments, and I know that not everybody's going to like this, and this is for the potential clawback that might arise if somebody breaches the condition, that we account for this in the way that the staff proposed, whether we call it a contingent feature or not. So that is, it's taken into account only if the event occurs. So it isn't a vesting condition. Other conditions relative to service and performance will determine whether the shares have vested, and the expense will be accounted for or attributed over that period. In the event that the breach takes place and the ex-employee has to repay either cash or shares, that is accounted for when it happens and isn't factored into the fair value and isn't included as a probability because of the, I think, to be honest, the difficulty of estimating the probability and the fact that the probability is generally likely to be low. So there is no change to the true-up effect beyond the vesting date. Who would object to that approach? That's one. Okay, so we'll go forward with that one. Okay, so Jeho in disguise, you can count that as a minor victory.
Thank you.
But you haven't won the war yet. So can we go on to question two now? Staff, question two, do you agree with the recommendation of performance target should be fully combined with an explicit or implicit service requirement in order to constitute a performance condition? Does anybody disagree with the staff recommendation? Andrew?
I disagree with that. I just wanted to understand. I mean, if the staff are moving us towards the employee's perspective as opposed to the employer's perspective, and you've got a performance period that, say, can only be met, say, after 4 years, and the service condition is 3 years.
Well, that's a different question. That's question three.
Okay.
It's because you said there is a service condition that is attached to it. If there is no explicit or implicit service condition. So if the employee was promised some shares in the event that in 4 years' time the company profits had increased to X amount, whether or not the employee continued to work for the company, then you'd say there's no service condition attached to that. So is that really a performance condition? I think that's question two. Yeah.
I think question two also covers situations where there is a service period, it just happens to be less than the performance period. Right.
It's a more complex derivation of what Bob said, but yes.
Right. So it's not just we hand you shares and you can leave tomorrow. It's, you know, we hand you shares, you got to work for 3 years, but we're not going to know until four whether they vest.
Thank you. Okay. Laurence?
Yeah, it's the proposal in paragraph 28. I have a little bit problem with the word while the contrapartee is rendering the required services, because while means an immediate, a very clean cutoff, where we know that when an employee is rendering services over a substantially the same period, but an exact, but not exactly the same period as for the performance target. I would be a little bit softer, rather, not just on the one. Say, for example, you have a service period that is of 11 months, and the target is measured at after 12 months. I mean, and if there is nothing expected between the 12 months, I would say that basically the two coincide. And I would not I would not treat this performance target as a number, as a number scheme. So it's the while that bothers me a little bit. The while makes it too sharp a cutoff. So if we could soften it a little bit, and if committee members agree that there is some judgment assessment to make sure that the periods coincide.
All right. So can, are you answering question two, no or yes?
It's the fully, fully, it's substantially fully. If you tell me substantially, I say yes. If you just tell me fully, I say no.
Okay. So we'll take that as a yes. Ida?
I would answer yes, but I have just one question. Why, after we have said what you need to have in order to account for it with the true-up method, that's why we are making the distinction here, because we have these two accounting methods. Otherwise, you could say, well, why bother about distinguishing service and the other stuff? Now, if we need an explicit or implicit service requirement for a performance condition, why would we need to define what a performance condition is? Wouldn't it be easier to simply say, if there is a service condition, then you true up the rest? I don't distinguish the rest. I account for that granted for value. But maybe I'm missing something here. What? But if we say what you need to have in order to be a performance condition, which means showing up, is a service condition, why wouldn't we simply say service conditions and the rest? Or maybe I'm missing something.
Michael?
I agree with you. The question, though, is how do you separate the two different things that need to occur, the service condition and the performance target? Do you separate it by saying 3 years service condition in its entirety, look at that, and look at the 4-year performance target, look at that? Or do you say, I have a 3-year time frame during which I have both service and the performance target, and then in the 4th year, I don't have the service, but I still have the performance target. So this was one of the specific requests that came up to us that's creating this project. The staff recommend that, consistent with the fully combined, you look at the service condition on its own and the performance condition on its own. You do not bifurcate it through periods of time. To Laurence's point of the fully combined term, my personal view as far as drafting would be that it will be more, it will be easier to reflect the principles that it should be and in theory needs to be fully combined. However, I think in applying all IFRSs always, facts and circumstances need to be taken into account. So if the preparer, auditor, regulator, and everyone say this is materially consistent, we're not going to give poor accounting simply because you're off by a day or some sort of de minimis period. So I would prefer to not say substantially combined, because I would anticipate a request coming back into the interpretations committee asking us to clarify what is substantially. I would leave that to individual preparers, but that's my view.
And of course, we'll heed that warning, because Michael's about to go back into what he thinks is the real world, which is the world that submits all these questions to us. Scott?
No, I'm okay.
Ruth?
No, I just wanted to say that I support the staff's recommendation, and I think for practical purposes to help people use the standard, we do need to define a service condition and a performance condition just to help people work through, particularly when you have multiple elements in an award.
Okay, thanks. So I think we've got agreement on that. And then the final question, number three, does the committee agree with the staff recommendation of performance target that does not have a, and Laurence can read substantially but almost fully, combined explicit or implicit service requirement should be considered a non-vesting condition? Does anybody disagree with the staff? Okay. All right. So I think we've got agreement on those points. Thank you very much for that, Jay Ho. Are you going to introduce the project options, or is Michael going to do that?
Over to you, Michael.
We'll have Michael, okay. You're going to stay around, though, to share in the glory, I hope.
Now that we appear to have all of the kind of call it technical issues resolved, we need to turn to paper 2B and ask ourselves, how do we proceed to actually, you know, providing this guidance in reality? The staff analyzed multiple paths forward, the first of which is the issue of an interpretation. And the staff believes that this is a viable option, albeit it may be introducing more changes into IFRS 2 than it is simply adding additional information. It's kind of, you know, we're proposing to change some wording in IFRS 2 for our staff recommendation. We think that the concept in theory, we are interpreting and providing better, more clear guidance on what is a service condition, what is a performance condition. In the staff's opinion, we don't think we've changed any of the principles of IFRS 2. We've simply filled in some of the blanks. And as evidenced by the end answers, kind of the before and after answers, we haven't changed any of the before and after answers. We've simply reduced diversity in some of the areas. So we do think that's one possible path forward. The second is incorporating this proposed change into the annual improvements process. The staff have looked at the proposed criteria that is now out for consideration, and the staff do believe that it does satisfy all these criteria. Well, while it may be a larger number of words that change as compared to other annual improvements items, we don't see the changes to be significant changes, as evidenced by the fact that none of the accounting answers have changed. Additionally, if the committee doesn't like that, we could propose that the board take this on as a separate project. While I think that that is something that could be out there, in looking at the board's work plan, I would personally see that as an uphill battle to get it added to the agenda. And a final thing is to simply do nothing right now to remove it formally from the committee's agenda and recommend that these issues be incorporated into the post-implementation review. What are the IFRIC's thoughts?
All right, perhaps the key thing I'd like to just focus on first is the assertion that Michael made that this isn't going to result in a change in accounting. I think it's going to focus people more clearly on the one type of accounting that perhaps was always intended by the original drafters of the board, and it appears to be clearing up a number of areas that have given some practical difficulty and concern. Would you agree, or does anybody disagree, I suppose I should ask, does anybody disagree that this will not change current accounting? Did I get too many knots in there? Scott?
I think you probably said it right. This is not changing the intent of IFRS 2, and that the answers here are what I think the drafters of IFRS 2 probably intended at the time. I think it probably will change accounting, because I think we're here because we have evidence of the fact that people were reading it different ways. So that, I think it probably will cause some changes. I
as far as the recommendation, doing it in annual improvements is fine with me. Doing it as an interpretation would be fine as well. I think that's a matter of style, and you know, if we do it as an annual improvement, are we worried it might get lost in the proposal? And if so, maybe doing it as an interpretation gives it a little more visibility, but that's about the only difference I see at this point.
Laurence?
I have difficulty responding to this question until I have understood what's the correct treatment for SAYE plans and whether we would be changing the SAYE plans accounting. I know that at the moment the committee said it doesn't change, but I feel that with what I read, the accounting answer that the committee decided on in July doesn't fit with what is written. And so as long as I have not a complete understanding of the consistency of the answers to all the elements we have seen, I have difficulty assessing whether it is more than an annual improvement. I don't think it
is. Ruth?
I thought we agreed we weren't going to change the account for SAYE plans at the last meeting because the standard had just been amended to make those changes and we weren't going to go back on them. I wouldn't support going with an interpretation because I think that makes it too complicated. I think this is more than an annual improvement. It's a pretty big improvement if we were going to do it. But I think for practical purposes, and I'd be interested in the board members' views, I think the IFRIC has come so far with this project that we could see it through, which means we could take on the amendment to IFRS 2 ourselves and do it ourselves, and then perhaps recommend it to the board to process as a separate amendment to IFRS 2. But I'm worried that it goes beyond what you would normally expect to see in an annual improvement. But I would be happy to take it on as a separate project to amend IFRS 2 on behalf of the board if that's something we could do.
Okay. Bent?
Well, to your first question, if it changes anything, if it does not change the meaning of the standard and if it does not change the accounting that is out there, then why do anything? Obviously, there must be some diversity out there which must be changed. So we do not change the meaning of the standard, but we change it or we get rid of the diversity, so we should do something about it. I think an interpretation, although when I read the staff paper, I think the staff likes the idea of making an interpretation. I think interpretation is not the right way forward because in paragraph 7 you say, would be an interpretation that directly amends portions of IFRS 2. I'm not sure that we can do it by an interpretation changing a standard. It must be an either AIP or a broader project. So an interpretation cannot change a standard. That was my understanding so far. So we cannot do an interpretation only.
Maybe I just come back to you on that it is within the remit of this committee to make recommendations for changes to the standards, and we can do that as part of the interpretation process if it makes the interpretation, shall we say, more concise and clearer. But any change to the standard would require a slight variance, shall we say, in our normal process. Our normal process for issuing an interpretation, as we did just recently on waste removal, was for negative clearance from the board at the draft stage. If there's a change to a standard that's proposed, then the board would have to deliberate first, because even if we do all the work, the board itself is the one that proposes the changes to the standards. So that would involve the board at an earlier stage. But it is something that can be done. So you shouldn't put it off the table just because it involves the board as part of the process at an earlier stage.
Well, I think either way, it's either an AIP project or part of a bigger project, as Ruth said, because we're changing the wording of the standard quite substantially when you look at paper 2C.
Okay. Peggy?
Yes, I would agree with those views as well. I mean, we've talked about this topic. This is our third meeting that we've been talking about it. It took us an hour just to get to this point this morning with a lot of discussion. And although I understand that this might be technically we're not changing any accounting, in practice, I'm not sure that that's the case. And because it's involving stock options, it affects that every company, every public company anyway. And so I would recommend either having it be part of the annual improvements project or as part of the post-mortem review.
Okay. Jean-Louis?
I support the work of clarification which has been done by the staff. I guess that I think that is going further than a mere interpretation, so I share the view that either we should go the improvements way or separate project. Maybe a separate project makes sense because there might be some implication, indirect implication on the project we are not in a position to measure now that could be substantial, so probably I would have a preference for asking the board to take the project starting from the work we have performed in order to finalize it with the recommendation within this document, because it would create maybe a wider debate and a wider possibility for comments on maybe some consequences we are not in a position to imagine now. That's my view.
In terms of the first question about does it change accounting, I think that if we're actually sitting here saying it doesn't change accounting, then actually the fourth option, we should be doing nothing, is actually the right option, because our role is in relation to where there is diversity out there. I think though that it may be that it is not changing what we believe the intent of IFRS 2 is, although there is confusion because there is a lack of clarity in IFRS 2, and therefore there is diversity out there, which is why we're looking at it. Because to me, I have to admit, within the four options, and the fourth one wasn't actually articulated in the paper, the four options are the two options to me are annual improvements or do nothing. I think having got this far, and the fact that, as Peggy said, it's taken us an hour because there is a lack of clarity, and that's where I keep coming back to and saying, I really do not think it is an interpretation. I do not think it is a necessary and urgent thing. And despite the fact that you say we can change words in the standard, or amend the standards through an interpretation, the amendment that we would be looking for as an interpretation, to me, is far, from what I understand an interpretation as, is far wider than an interpretation. I understand, and I think the solution of maybe us actually doing an amendment as opposed to the board doing one, if the board could live with that, and I don't want to extend our role any further, that is a possibility. But I do believe when you look at those criteria that we talked about around annual improvements and what's just come out from the foundation, I actually do think if we are right, although it is an awful lot of words, all we are doing is making the standard clearer. We're giving it clarity, I think, is what we're doing. And therefore, if we can get that drafting right and you know, in what is there in 2C, and we've got a long way and we haven't talked about it yet, but if we can get that drafting right and we can truly get the clarity and we can explain it in a good basis for conclusions, I actually think that annual improvements is the way to go.
Andrew?
I struggle with annual improvements, actually. I mean, you just look at there's a lot of word changes. We are potentially introducing new principles about the employee's perspective rather than employer's perspective. We're introducing things like contingent features and attribution periods. So in the spirit of annual improvements, I really struggle. So I think for me, it would either be a separate board project or the post-implementation review. If we did an interpretation, I think it would be an interpretation in the guise of a separate board project, rather like Ruth was saying. But I struggle see this as an annual improvement. I also look at the comments at the back of peeking ahead at the back of paper 2C and the comments that have been received so far, there's lots of agrees, disagrees, so I don't think it's a simple correction or amendment to clarify the existing standard.
Okay. Guido?
I would opt for an annual improvement project, you know, looking what we are trying to find out what we are really addressing here. I think are three issues. One is where you have different service periods with an and or condition between them. We could call that attribution period or not. I think we don't need that word. We could also handle it with still calling it what the vesting period at the end of the day is when you have this different condition. So that's fine for an annual improvement. The other question was, how do you define a performance condition? I think the answer to that we found is you need to have implicit or explicit service condition. Yeah, we can deal with that in annual improvement. The one that is a little bit more complicated is the non-compete, the contingent feature issue, which, that's my understanding, was not in the standard before, but I think we could also handle that in annual improvement. Having said that, annual improvement seems to be the right answer, but then we need to, maybe we should take the chance to make also other things clearer when we come to 2C, and I don't want to talk about that right now. There are still defined terms. For instance, the Save As You Earn plan for me is a non-vesting condition, which doesn't make sense because it is a vesting condition. It is a non-service condition, but it is a vesting condition. Maybe we should take the opportunity to make that clearer also to the users. But okay, my option would be yes, it's an annual improvement.
Okay, I'll ask our ISB board members for their comments in a moment, but just to reflect back on what a lot of you have been saying, the key thing in here is that the theme that's coming across is that we think we've come up with a solution or a set of solutions that are consistent with the way that IFRS 2 was intended to be applied originally. One of the ways in which we could address that, if in fact, and I think it is a matter of fact that there is diversity in practice, so doing nothing is not one of the options in here. I'll perhaps rephrase or phrase the question inappropriately, but deliberately in that way, because we need to test whether or not the extent of the changes that we are likely to create as a result of this project are so substantial, so pervasive, that in fact there would be outrage if it was to go through the annual improvements process. People are less concerned, still upset if they have to change the accounting, but if we go through the interpretation process because it's standalone, then it's clear. So the reason I think that we could say it is an interpretation with what appear to be substantial changes to the text of the existing standard are that we are interpreting the principles on which IFRS 2 was originally based and the application of those specifically to remove diversity and at the same time to reduce the length and complexity of the interpretation by making specific changes into the standard. That would require a fairly substantial amount of work at the board, I would expect, to be able to reassure the board that the proposals that have been discussed and will be discussed possibly again next meeting of this committee are in fact something that is consistent within the whole suite. The board takes its responsibilities for IFRS very seriously, so they're not just going to rubber stamp what comes from this committee. On the other hand, I think they should have some reassurance that the fact that this committee comprised as it is of at least 14 very wise and sensible people, I'm talking about the voting members, that you represent a broad spectrum of the business community, and therefore there is more assurance that the conclusion that you've reached is one that is in fact consistent with the principles of IFRS 2 and will achieve a measure of acceptability in the marketplace. So a board change in some way is going to be required. Many of you have felt that this meets the criteria for an annual improvement, and as you know, just this week the Foundation published the proposals, which we have discussed before in this committee, for the criteria for annual improvements. But nevertheless, it does seem to be a lot of change in a very sensitive area, so we have to be absolutely sure that it does meet that criteria. One of the other alternatives, which is not quite the do nothing, but is to take a breather, is in fact to make a recommendation that this issue itself is put onto the board agenda in the form of background to alert the board, first of all, that we have been discussing these issues, what the problems were, what the alternatives are, and what the recommended solution is, with a recommendation from the committee as to the action that we're going to take. But because it's going to involve, no matter which route you follow, changes to the standard, for the board, in fact, to give some consideration and direction as to whether it wants to employ the interpretation committee to complete the work on its behalf, subject obviously then to board debate and approval at a later stage, or if the board wants to take it together with the other issues that have been identified on IFRS 2, and there are many of those at some stage in a larger project that it would want to put onto its agenda at some time, I would guess, after June 2011. But Patricia and Wei Guo, perhaps you have some comments and observations. I hope one of the comments is that we're improving financial reporting with these changes, but can I put you on the spot?
I think the decision about how to implement these changes is almost as difficult as coming to the conclusion of what the right answers were in the first place. I think the board is at risk to be criticized if we do it as an interpretation or if we do it as an annual improvement. I think those who don't want any tinkering with IFRS 2 at all are going to criticize it either way. They're going to argue that it doesn't meet the definition of an interpretation because of the amount of wording changes that would be necessary to the standard. If we do it as an annual improvement, they'll argue that it wasn't too many changes and it wasn't visible, buried in another standard. So I think it's going to be, it has to be, I think, a board decision about how to proceed. And it would seem that we're so close to doing the post-implementation review of IFRS 2 that perhaps this should just come from the Interpretations Committee as a recommendation for a direction to take in the post-implementation review and make it a very open and lengthy process, because these are probably not the only issues that exist in IFRS 2.
Yeah. Wait, right?
I agree with many of the members' views. It should be in between annual improvement or a separate project. But it is hard for the board to add more projects and current the environment. And if you go back in the past several years, a separate project as an amendment are basically, as I understand, two or three categories. One are so urgent as a result of the financial crisis, like right issues, reclassification. A second category will be such a strong call from a region like put options and others. And this one, if we want to justify board members, they are closely related to the financial crisis, not. And this is a problem so many countries call their big flaw, not. So it is hard now to add to the board agenda as a separate project. So I will lenient to, and I not want to provide my views, you know. If we do want to finish, maybe annual improvement will be a good choice. But I also agree with some of board members, the committee members' observations, you know, before packet into a final ED, maybe we should try our best to clear the wordings and make
much more acceptable.
Thanks. Patrick.
Thank you. Well, I just would like to underline that the current proposal is a very long list of changes to definitions in the standard, to application guidance, to implementation guidance, and therefore I share the views of many members of the committee who said that it goes beyond and it would be necessary to fully understand the consequences of those changes. And I also would like to underline something said by Andrew, which is that switching the perspective of the standard from the entity's perspective to the employee's perspective as a potential for very significant impact on the application of the standard, and therefore I think this committee and the board should look at this specific aspect of the proposal in order to reach a decision.
Okay, Andrew.
Well, I liked your suggestion, Bob, because I find it really odd, given the volume of discussion we've had here, the volume of changes, at least in words, that we might be contemplating making, can do this without a steer from the board as to where we should be headed. I just find it very strange for this. In these circumstances, we're overturning in a number of respects, and certainly in terms of words, the 2008 amendment that the board spent a lot of time discussing. And I just find it very strange that we sit here and, without going back to the board and asking their views before we decided anything.
Joanna?
And I'm supporting that. I think what you said and what Patricia said about raising it with the board and having the discussion with the board, and I look at it slightly different way in terms of I'm thinking, oh, is it because we're opting out of making a decision? But I don't think that it is that. I just think that it's absolutely, as you say, whatever happens, the board will have to be involved. I mean, they should be involved anyway, but you know, it involves the board, and therefore I think to make the comments and have the discussion at the board level and say, yes, we're prepared to do the work, but we want some guidance from you. So I actually really support that approach. Sure. And whether we do it after we've come up with some, if you like, words, 2C type words that we're happy with, or whether we do it before, I'm not sure.
Patrick? Oh, sorry, Julie.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seems like it's a two-step question for the board. The first step is we've analyzed the practice problems, and we think the only way, or the best way, to skin the cat, if you will, is to make a level of changes as kind of as illustrated, which are fairly significant. And there isn't a lesser way to solve the problem, you know. And so does the board agree that there isn't a lesser way to conquer it, and it really will take, you know, this level of revision or change in philosophy to conquer the issue. If the board agrees with that, then it's a practical question of how do you, you know, deal with constituents in the due process with these types of changes. But if the board doesn't agree that it takes this level of change to address it, I think there is a lesser way to do it. Then that would be good to know, because then some lesser way to do it might better fit in annual improvements or in an interpretation. So it seems like the first question to the board is, do you agree kind of the only way to solve the problem is kind of like this, and that this is IFRIC's recommendation, which is kind of a higher order magnitude than we kind of normally come up with. And if they agree, then they can join in the issue of how do we deal with due process when you have that magnitude. And if they don't agree, then it doesn't matter, because they can think of another way to do it, which may fit more nicely. So I would just suggest putting it to them in those two ways, because we're sort of assuming that they agree that it will take the style of revision to address it, and we're jumping to how would we do it, and maybe they would see it differently. Or once they do agree, then they're jointly into the issue of process, and they can best decide, which I think was some of the comments.
Okay. Okay. Guido?
I also agree that we should ask the board how we should go forward, but by proposing something to the board, I think we could do one thing without leaving the other. Looking at the issues that we address here, there are, in my view, two which could be included in annual improvement, because there are really lesser changes. We wouldn't have to change definitions and this kind of stuff. What I'm talking about is this performance condition, that it should include service condition. That's easy to do. I think that's in the spirit of the standard. And the other one is, how do we deal with different vesting periods? The other issue is changing the perspective to the employee, or talking about non-compete or contingent features in general. I think those are the very major changes, which I would also say, well, maybe we should not include them in an annual improvement, and that could be done dealt with in a post-implementation review by the board. So maybe we could split it, have the practice dealing with these easy issues could be included in annual improvement, and the larger ones and post-implementation review.
All right, then what I'm going to put to you now is that we make, well, the staff actually have to do this, if you can get some agenda time with the board, and you should raise it anyway at the September meeting when you give the IFRIC update, to alert the board that you want time to discuss this issue, to raise with them, actually, the issues that are of concern. Perhaps, as Guido suggested, you can in some way rank them as those that are easy to fix and would fit within annual improvements comfortably, and those that are more of a change and may cause some questions as to whether they fit with annual improvements. To clarify for the board that there are practice issues that need to be addressed, and that this committee feels that it can be done through, well, I'm assuming what I'm going to propose is that you feel it should be best done by change to the standard itself. And for the board then to consider whether it wants to take on any of these issues at the moment. Some a subset that perhaps are the low-hanging fruit that could easily go through annual improvements, or all of them, either as annual improvements or as a separate package. Or, in fact, as has been suggested, perhaps to defer this until the post-implementation review gets underway and to include all of these issues with everything else. But also with the offer of assistance. We know that the staff has to do the work anyway, whether it's the board who's telling you what to do or the committee. But the offer of assistance from this committee to do such further work as is necessary to make the drafting changes and set them forward. Does anybody object to that approach? Because I'm hopeful that we'll find time before we next have to meet, so that our next meeting we will at least know what the board decision is, if not to be informed at an earlier stage when the staff can actually come back and start working on whatever needs to be done. And on that basis, I'd suggest that we don't go through a paper 2C, but to await what the board's decision is. It would be helpful, I think, to the staff, to the extent that you haven't already given comments or you would like to give more comments on the changes to the standard itself, not the examples, the application guidance and the basis, but just on the changes to the authoritative standard. If you have any comments, to send those through to the staff, because you may want to use that as an indication of the extent of the changes that we're talking about. Put it in context.
All right. I think we would, that there are four questions that we had put back in Appendix B. We would greatly appreciate your personal thoughts on that to assist us in drafting offline.
Okay. Let's take a 10-minute comfort break, and then we can come back to more IFRS 2 issues.